The reason why this sandal lost so much weight will shock you. It's not just a detail. It is the tactical decision at the very heart of one of the most disturbing and, frankly, one of the most overlooked crimes of the entire early 20th century.
And that transformation, that conscious choice to physically change his own body, that's the ultimate proof of planning. It's chilling.
Right.
When we look at historical horror stories, we tend to focus on, the event itself, the
The
climax.
bloody part.
Exactly. But the story, it forces you to look at the preparation, the deep, intimate betrayal that came before, and really the weaponization of the highest form of community trust.
That's it. That's what we're doing today. We are opening up the files on what the historical sources all call the 1917 Sandy case.
Yep.
Our mission is, well, it's forensic, it's sociological, and it is deeply, deeply unsettling. We're going to unpack the details of this 3-week Christmas killing spree that just descended on this small, tightly knit community in northern Massachusetts.
Right in the dead of winter, 1917.
And it's so important that you, listening, really grasp the context of 1917.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a time when isolation wasn't a feeling, it was a geographical fact, especially in rural New England.
Totally.
These towns were, they were self-sufficient. They were little islands,
Yeah.
and they were governed entirely by local custom and a complete dependence on the trust they placed in their community pillars.
Authority wasn't a guy with a badge who showed up from the city.
No, not at all. Authority was reputation. It was earned over decades.
So if a figure held that kind of authority, that kind of reputation, they basically held the keys to the entire town. I
Yeah.
mean, literally and figuratively.
Both. And that key, that automatic, unquestioned access, that is what makes this entire story of Nickelodeon just so bone-chilling.
We're going to track how one man, a figure everyone saw as pure benevolence, weaponized his own status to achieve a scale of devastation that is. It's just hard to wrap your head around, even now.
This is a real deep dive into historical vulnerability. We're going to trace the specific steps of his transformation, the mechanics of this 3-week spree, and then the chilling forensic implication of that final piece of evidence they found on Christmas morning.
Yeah.
It's not just a crime story, it's a terrifying lesson in how, cultural expectation, how ritual can completely blind a community to a danger that is hiding in plain sight.
Okay, so we have to start with the man himself. We have to. If you don't understand the magnitude of the betrayal, the rest of it doesn't hit as hard.
Exactly.
So this is Act One, the town Santa, Nickelodeon. Before we get into any of the horror, we have to appreciate the depth of devotion, the sheer institutional trust this one man commanded.
Absolutely. You have to maximize the contrast. You need to feel who he was before 1917 to understand the operational monster he became.
Right, if you skip that
It
part.
just becomes another violent story. It loses its intellectual punch.
His name is almost, it sounds like folklore, doesn't it? Nickelodeon.
It's almost too perfect.
Yeah, sounds mythical. And in this tiny northern Massachusetts community, long before, the big department stores like Macy's or Gimbel's had really monopolized the image of Santa Claus, Nick was their Santa.
He was the genuine article.
Yeah, he wasn't some seasonal worker they hired. He was a tradition, incarnate.
And in those days, especially in these isolated places, the idea of Santa was often rooted in a local elder, a respected figure who just took on the role.
Someone you knew your whole life.
Exactly. Sometimes they inherited it. This wasn't a costume you rented for a party. It was an identity you earned. You earned it through years of reliable service and just genuine kindness.
And the sources are so clear that his value to the community, it went so far beyond just handing out toys.
Oh, way beyond.
Yes, he dressed up as Santa every year.
Right.
Yes, he handed out gifts, probably homemade things, locally sourced stuff.
Yeah.
But his real function was like structural to the town.
He was a pillar.
He actively helped the community by fixing broken things. That's the quote from the source. And he provided this crucial social care by checking on the lonely.
Okay, and that's where the sociological analysis really bites. Let's just pause on that.
Yeah, Lex.
Think about what being the town handyman and the social caregiver gave a person in 1917. First, knowledge of vulnerability. He knew who was lonely, who lived alone, who was maybe, frail or dependent on others.
He knew who wouldn't be missed right away.
Precisely. And second, architectural access. This is a big one. If Nick is the guy who fixes things, he has a legitimate, completely unquestioned reason to be inside your home.
And not just in the parlor.
No, he's in places no one else would ever see.
He's not just there to fix a wobbly chair leg. He's in your cellar, checking on the coal furnace. He's up on your roof, sealing a leak near the chimney.
He's checking the latches on your back windows because they get stuck in the winter. He's looking at the security of your door bolts because you mentioned one was loose.
So he was. He was intimately familiar with the structural and the mechanical weaknesses of nearly every single home in that town.
He was a living blueprint of the entire community's security flaws. He had ubiquitous, unquestioned access. He had established a non-negotiable reason to enter every single home. And because he's doing it all under this, you know, this guise of selfless community service.
No one's watching him.
No one's tracking his movements. No one is asking why he spent 20 minutes in the basement. They're just grateful.
So he knew every family structure, every house's layout, every weakness, and every single family's daily routine.
He wasn't just a trusted neighbor. He was an embedded, essential part of how the town functioned. He was the exception to every rule of small town suspicion.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Anyone else, a stranger, comes to your door at night.
You're grabbing the shotgun.
Right. But if Nickelodeon knocks, you're opening that door before he even finishes knocking. You're probably inviting him in for a hot drink.
The town relied on him. His presence wasn't just welcomed. It was anticipated. It was celebrated. And this level of earned trust, that became the killer's primary operational asset.
It's the ultimate long con.
It is. It's spending years, maybe decades, building a reputation just so you can learn how to bypass every single security measure, legally and psychologically.
He was the absolute gravitational center of this town's Christmas. He was the anchor of their entire winter, which is why the details around his reappearance after he'd been gone for a while are so profoundly unsettling.
The groundwork had been laid for years. Now the stage was set for the operation to begin.
So we transition from this beloved community pillar to the disturbing change.
And it starts with an absence. Nickelodeon hadn't been seen for nearly a whole year.
And in a town this size, where everyone's business is everyone's business.
That would have been the main topic of conversation, a constant source of anxiety. Where's Nick? Is he okay? What are we going to do for Christmas?
Right. His annual appearance wasn't just for fun. It was an emotional necessity for them. The pressure for him to come back, to restore that Christmas ritual, it must have been immense.
And so when he finally does reappear, right around December 1917, something is immediately and profoundly off.
The sources all document this physical transformation as being just immediate and jarring.
The visual is key here. You can just imagine the whispers spreading through the town.
He'd lost a significant, an unnatural amount of weight.
All the things that made him Santa, they were gone. The iconic round cheeks, the big comforting belly, the very physical attributes that defined his local legend just vanished.
His authentic Santa costume, you know, the one Pearlie custom made for him years ago, it hangs off him.
He's gaunt. He looks unwell. He doesn't look jolly.
But, and this is the critical psychological moment, the failing that made the whole spree possible. The town chose willful blindness.
Yes. They saw the dramatic physical change. They saw all the red flags, all the danger signs. But they chose to override them with ritual. They did not want to lose their Santa.
They rationalized it. They told each other stories.
Oh, he must have been sick. He's been through so much this past year.
Yeah, he's being heroic, just trying his best to put on a good performance for the children.
To maintain the spirit of the holiday despite his illness. It's a classic case of community-wide cognitive dissonance.
Let's explain that.
Their desperate, almost primal need to cling to normalcy, to that deeply ingrained Christmas ritual, it just completely superseded the obvious physical reality in front of them.
The psychological inertia was too strong.
Way too strong. So they rationalized away the emaciation, ignoring this clear signal that this was functionally a different person, a compromised person, a potentially dangerous person.
They accepted a shadow in place of the substance. They let the costume, that red suit, dictate their response while ignoring the sickly, unfamiliar man inside it.
And crucially, despite his obvious physical decay, they let their own children approach him, let them sit on his lap.
They wanted to believe.
And that acceptance, that collective decision to trust the memory of Nick over the reality of the changed man standing before them, that was the moment the clock started ticking.
By welcoming this compromised figure back into the fold.
They ensured the killer had the maximum level of operational freedom. They handed it to him.
Which brings us right into the heart of the darkness. Act 2, the 3-week erasing spree. And this section, it requires us to grapple not just with the horror of the violence itself, but with the terrifying scale and the cold mechanical consistency of the entire operation.
The timing is just clinically precise. It suggests a level of planning and a confidence that you rarely see in, you know, serial crimes.
Right.
The trouble began exactly on December 1st, coinciding perfectly with Nick's return to full public visibility. And it continued relentlessly for 3 weeks straight.
21 days.
Right.
21 consecutive days of terror. And that consistency is what really defines the trauma, and it showcases the killer's absolute impunity.
The pattern never broke. Every single night it held, an entire family would be found deceased the following morning.
Not just one person. The entire household.
The functional unit of the family. Targeted and eliminated.
This is so important for the analysis. This wasn't a killer driven by some impulsive rage or just random opportunity.
Not at all. Targeting entire households night after night, it suggests the highly calculated methodology. It suggests a deep, intimate knowledge of local routines and a logistical capacity to incapacitate multiple people very quickly and very silently.
He was operating with the confidence that his identity was protected by this. This impenetrable shield.
This shield of community trust he'd spent years building.
So let's talk about the scale of the devastation, because I think this is a detail that often gets lost when people focus just on the killer Santa part.
It's the most important metric, really.
We're told that by the end of this 3-week spree, almost half of the town's population had been erased.
You really have to pause on that. Half.
Half the town.
This wasn't a crime wave. This was a functional obliteration of a community. In a small integrated town like this, losing 50% of your residents, it doesn't just mean a high body count.
It means the total collapse of civil society.
Exactly. I mean, think about who makes up that missing half in 1917. It's not just random people.
You're losing entire family lines. You probably lose the town selectman, the postmaster.
The only doctor for miles, the school teacher, the local blacksmith who shoes the horses, the volunteer fire chief.
The people who actually make the town run.
Yes. The removal of those key citizens means total societal isolation and infrastructural failure. The local economy just stops. Half the workforce is gone. There's no authority structure left to even manage the crisis.
The emotional and societal impact would be, what, like a terminal collapse? The remaining people are just plunged into this state of total paralyzed isolation and fear.
Absolute terror. And it was sustained. How do you maintain any sense of normalcy when a killer is operating with complete impunity, erasing households night after night for 3 solid weeks, and leaving absolutely no traditional trace of how they got in or out?
That is the core of the forensic puzzle, isn't it? It's defined entirely by the negative evidence.
Yes. What was missing from these crime scenes provides the strongest implication of the killer's identity and their method.
So tell us what the police, and we're talking about 1917 investigation techniques here, what did they not find at any of these scenes?
Okay, so crucially, they found no overturned chairs, no lamps knocked over, nothing to indicate a struggle.
So the victims were caught completely unaware.
Or incapacitated. They also found no broken windows. That rules out the quick, silent glass entry. And most damningly of all, no signs of forced entry on any door.
No splintered wood, no broken latches.
No pry marks, no evidence of lock picks being used. In a typical 1917 home, which would have been bolted and locked against the cold and, you know, strangers, this lack of disturbance is almost impossible if the entry was unwanted.
If you're a small town constable in 1917, you're looking for physical rupture, a broken lock, a muddy footprint, signs of a fight.
That's your playbook.
And when you find none of that, night after night, your initial theories must have been just baffling. Are we dealing with a ghost? Did these families just vanish?
The initial theories would have been chaos. Police probably considered, you know, internal family disputes that ended tragically. Or maybe poisonings where the killer was part of the family.
Mass suicide, maybe, given the economic stress or the recent flu epidemic.
They would have considered all of it. But none of those theories could account for the sheer scale and that consistent nightly rhythm across totally unrelated households. And the lack of struggle implies the victims were incapacitated either before or immediately upon entry.
And this is where we have to circle back to Nickelodeon's history.
It all comes back to him.
The implication is just terrifying.
Yeah.
If there was no forced entry, then the killer either had a key.
Or was invited in.
Or use a non-standard point of entry that left the home completely undisturbed.
And given Nick's history as the town handyman, he could have easily copied keys over the years, made duplicates. Or he could have identified and exploited a weak known bolt that he himself had installed years ago and knew how to jimmy open.
And even if he didn't use a key, he used the permission his role granted him.
Yes. The lack of struggle reinforces that. I mean, just picture the scene. A respected local figure shows up at your door in the evening, maybe under the guise of, just wanted to check on your furnace with this cold snap, or, oh, I forgot to deliver this late gift for the little one.
No one is alarmed. No one raises their voice. The family's guard isn't just lowered, it's completely absent.
He didn't need to force his way in. He had earned his access over decades. The houses were all secured against strangers, you know, bandits, drifters, maybe even German agents, given the war context.
But they were completely porous to him, to the trusted community pillar.
The community was killed by the very system of trust they had relied on for their survival.
So the police are completely cornered. They're looking for an outsider, a rupture, a break in the social fabric.
And they never considered that the threat wasn't external. It was the very foundation of the community itself. How do you investigate a ghost who leaves no physical trace and is protected by 20 years of cultural expectation?
You wait for the weather to turn. You wait for the environment itself to strip away the killer's operational flexibility and force them into a corner that finally leaves some kind of physical evidence.
And that is exactly what happened on Christmas Eve. The ultimate expression of the crime was dictated by the elements.
The story shifts now. It moves from this psychological terror to a forensic analysis that's dictated entirely by Mother Nature. We're moving into Act 3. The blizzard and the chimney.
The scene that finally breaks the case.
And the environment. The environment provided the trap.
It did. On Christmas Eve, a massive blizzard swept through the entire region. Now, in northern Massachusetts in 1917, this isn't just an inconvenience. This is a complete environmental shutdown.
Roads become utterly impassable. Gone.
Snowdrifts pile up higher than the houses, effectively creating total isolation between every single household. Visibility drops to near zero. Any movement outside is immediately noticeable, but it's also impossible to conceal your tracks.
And the blizzard created another critical physical necessity, one that served as the killer's only remaining vulnerability.
The reliance on heat.
Yes. Residents, stranded and cut off from the world, relied absolutely on their wood or coal fireplaces to stay warm, to literally stay alive during the sustained, deadly cold of the storm.
This one detail elevates the role of the chimney dramatically. The fireplace, which is normally this, you know, comforting symbol of home and security.
A hearth.
Right. It instantly became the single point of failure for the entire house's security. The house was sealed by its locks, and now it was sealed by feet of snow. But the chimney had to remain open. It had to remain operational to prevent the family from freezing to death.
So, logistically, think about the killer's constraints now.
They've completely changed.
If the ground is covered in this fresh, deep, undisturbed snow, entering through a door or a window would leave unmistakable tracks. Even if you got in, your exit would leave a clear path leading away.
And with the police already hyper-aware and the whole town on edge, tracks were completely out of the question. It would be a signed confession.
So the snow-sealed environment essentially forced the killer, if they wanted to continue the spree. If they wanted to get to the final remaining families, they had to use the one route that the cold weather demanded stay open.
A route that would not leave tracks on the ground. A route that could be entered and exited vertically and that bypassed all conventional entry points.
If the killer was obsessed with maintaining that consistency and the door and window method was now forensically impossible to conceal because of the snow, the number of viable options just dropped to one.
Zero. Except for the chimney, which was being actively used, drawing air, keeping the fire going.
Then we get to the final scene. Christmas morning, the Smith family home.
This was the last house targeted before the whole thing was finally broken open.
The police. And you have to imagine they're operating in just a state of sheer desperation and exhaustion by this point.
21 days of this.
They're called to the Smith family home. And the scene is horrifically familiar, but it's also uniquely baffling because of the weather.
The house is just still, frozen in time. Inside, the rooms are entirely undisturbed.
Again, no signs of forced entry, even though the massive blizzard outside would have made a conventional breach impossible to hide. The killer had operated successfully, even through the worst weather conditions imaginable.
The stillness inside, contrasted with the absolute chaos of the storm raging outside, it painted this perfect, terrifying picture of horror.
And this continuity of silence, despite the extreme weather, it confirmed for the police that the killer had to possess some extraordinary, dedicated, and highly specific means of entry and exit, something that bypassed all the normal forensic rules and all the environmental challenges.
They were looking for a crack in the foundation, a broken latch, something that would betray a violent intrusion.
The officers are searching everywhere. Doors, windows, cellar entrances. They find nothing. It looks like the 22nd perfect crime. This one's sealed by the snow.
But then, as the sources recount it, one of the officers, maybe prompted by the sheer sick irony of the date, Christmas Day, and the method of entry Santa is famous for,
he suggests checking an unconventional location.
They needed to account for every possibility. They had to find the one point of stress where the killer, forced by the elements into this one method, might have finally slipped up, might have left a telltale sign of their passage.
And that is the pivotal moment, the moment that breaks the case wide open. The single detail that wraps this entire horror story right back to our initial hook and to Nickelodeon's transformation.
That is when they checked under the family's chimney.
And the source material just lets that implication hang there, dense and heavy, in the snow-sealed silence of the Smith family home. We know that the killer, Nickelodeon, had lost a significant amount of weight. He was visibly emaciated. He was no longer the round, jolly figure of years past.
And this is that aha moment, the one that retroactively explains the entire scenario and why the depth of that initial betrayal is so profound.
The community assumed he was sick.
Yep.
The police were looking for a fat man in a red suit who didn't fit the profile of a silent killer.
The question was always there, hanging in the air. Why did Nickelodeon lose so much weight?
And the answer wasn't illness. It was preparation. He was physically preparing for the only route left into a locked and secure home during a New England winter, the chimney.
The physical dimensions of a residential flue in 1917 are, they're narrow. They were designed for smoke and soot, not for a person to pass through.
We're talking what, 18 inches wide? 24 at best.
At best, and that's before years of soot buildup and internal irregularities in the brickwork. To navigate the average domestic chimney, he had to be significantly underweight. This transformation wasn't incidental. It was a professional, tactical necessity for his mission.
He transformed his own body to enable the methodical mass murder of his entire community. And he leveraged the one cultural loophole, the Santa myth, that granted him guaranteed, accepted access to any home in December.
He had to become small enough to navigate that extremely narrow, soot-covered flue, and to do it silently while a family was sleeping just feet away.
So what would they have found under that chimney?
Well, not necessarily a body, but the forensic evidence. A concentration of fine-grained soot on the floorboards, or the rug that was too thick, too disturbed to have just been caused by a natural draw from the fire.
Microscopic fibers from his red suit, snagged on a rough piece of brick inside the flue.
Or a specific scrape mark on the hearthstone, indicating where a body had been lowered or pulled through that very tight opening. The kind of mark you wouldn't get from just adding logs to the fire.
The physical transformation that the town so willfully dismissed was, in fact, the most damning piece of preparation he undertook.
He had to be thin to be efficient. That year-long absence he took, it was likely a period of ascetic training, of starving himself, not a recovery from sickness.
It connects every single dot.
Yeah.
His long history gave him the knowledge of the houses, his social role gave him the unquestioned trust, and his physical, year-long tactical transformation allowed him to exploit the one entry point, the chimney, that was secure against conventional intruders and guaranteed him passage even during a blizzard.
The town's very source of warmth and comfort became the delivery mechanism for its own demise.
The ultimate horror here is just the depth of the planning. This wasn't a sudden snap. This was cold, calculated, operational discipline carried out over at least 12 months. He sacrificed his appearance, his health, his entire community recognition for one thing.
Absolute, undetectable access. He used the very physical mechanics of the myth against the people who believed in it.
Okay, so let's try to synthesize this. Let's wrap this up.
It's a terrifying historical account. We've traced this narrative through three horrific phases. First, the establishment of this deep structural community trust.
Then, the terrifying calculation and precision of the three-week spree that functionally just erased half the town.
And finally, the horrific forensic reveal of the chimney access method, a method that was dictated and ultimately exposed by the harsh winter environment.
I think the true horror, for me, it transcends the act of murder itself. It really lies in the vulnerability of our own minds, you know, how we react when a foundational ritual is subverted. The community invited the killer in based on deep-seated memory and ritual. even when the visual evidence, his emaciated appearance, was screaming a clear warning at them.
They prioritized their need for the comfort of the ritual over the reality of the threat.
They needed their Santa, and that powerful psychological need provided him with the perfect cover.
And the only thing that stopped the spree, in the end, wasn't superior police work. It wasn't community vigilance. It was an act of God, basically. An act of environmental severity, the blizzard, which inadvertently forced the killer into a method that finally left forensic evidence.
Evidence tied directly to his physical transformation.
It's a devastating lesson in applied sociology and community vulnerability. The killer didn't need to break down the door. He just weaponized the cultural invitation that every single family automatically extended to the idea of Nickelodeon.
It's fascinating, from a historical standpoint, that the weapon wasn't a gun or a knife. The weapon was trust itself. And the primary tool was the physical embodiment of the myth, meticulously altered to fit the architectural flaw.
That's right.
So we'll offer this as our concluding thought. The one-line takeaway from the 1917 Santa case as a chilling final lesson.
Sometimes the Santa you invite into your home isn't bringing gifts. He's taking whatever's left.
And this raises so many profound questions that go way beyond just this one crime, particularly given the scale of the devastation.
Right. Since almost half the town was functionally erased, you have to consider the long-term historical and societal impact. This wasn't a single tragedy. It was a societal collapse.
How does a town isolated and fractured like that, ever recover from that level of internal betrayal? Does the local economy ever rebound when half its productive citizens are just gone?
Is that massive gap in the population ever filled? Or is the town just permanently scarred, both structurally and psychologically, a ghost town with a few survivors?
And furthermore, does the very legend of Santa in that specific region of northern Massachusetts carry a permanent, unique stain now?
It has to. The most sacred symbol of goodwill and childhood innocence was systematically used to facilitate mass murder. Does that memory become irrevocably embedded in the local folklore?
Does it forever taint the image of the jolly man in red with the deep, visceral fear of a skinny, soot-covered figure emerging from the hearth?
These devastating internal betrayals, they don't just kill people, they fundamentally shatter cultural symbols. They alter the historical records of the places where they occurred.
It's a chilling reminder that sometimes the deepest lessons in history aren't found in the grand international events, but in these small, isolated communities where trust failed utterly and spectacularly.
It's a dark legend built entirely upon the expectation of Christmas magic. You have to wonder how long it took anyone in that community to ever light their fireplaces again without looking up first.
If you want to dive deeper into these types of overlooked histories and chilling legends, you can find the full breakdown and more early 20th century mysteries over on Inspector Story.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the darkest corner of Christmas history.
We'll see you next time.